it was an attempt to look ahead to say, you know, the tectonic shift you see that's happened economically with Asia was going to also happen in advertising and social terms given technology.
This is Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia, conversations with Asia's leading movers, shakers, thinkers, and provocateurs. In this episode, our topic is Asia and digital innovation. My guest is Kent Wertheim, the co-CEO of Ogilvy & Mather Asia Pacific. That was him just a second ago, talking about how the Asia market spurred innovation in digital platforms. As you're about to hear, Kent got his start in advertising. He was one of the very first to see the potential of digital platforms anywhere. Kent first wrote about what he was seeing in his groundbreaking book, Digimarketing, The Essential Guide to New Marketing and Digital Media. That was essential reading for me when I first arrived in Asia. It still is. Kent's also still thinking, still has his eye out for what's next. He's got deep knowledge and long experience, but he's also the sort of person who intuitively is always looking ahead. As always on Inside Asia, our interviews are on location. This time, it's the majestic lobby of the Westin Hotel in Singapore. Through tall glass windows, we had an unobstructed view of the harbor lights and office towers. I started off by asking Kent, as I often do, what brought him to Asia in the first place.
I got to Asia through basically fool's luck. I think ultimately by karma, because I was offered a job in Los Angeles about a week before I got my job in Hong Kong. And it was back in the days when I was working for another agency, and they had a job working on some company called Apple. And I flew out to Los Angeles and accepted the job when I got back to New York on a Friday. And then I was sick all weekend. And I met a woman named Martha Peace, who used to be with the agency in Los Angeles. She was working in New York. She just moved. And she was aware that I was talking with the folks in the LA office. And we met over coffee, and she said, "Oh, how was the interview?" And I said, "Great, I took the job." And she said, "Oh, you don't look well." And I said, "Well, I was sick all weekend." And she was very LA at the time, and she said, "Well, come talk with me." And I went into her office, and we sat down. And after talking for about 15 minutes, she looked at me, and she said, "Kent, your body's telling you you don't want this job." And it was this amazing cathartic moment. And I didn't know Martha very well, but she's one of those people that, you know, suddenly drops into your life and then completely alters your destiny, as happens at times. And as soon as she said it, I immediately realized that she was utterly right. It was like a dam bursting. And I walked back into the talent people at the time, and I said, "Look, I've been promised a role overseas." And I basically said, "I'm not going to go to Los Angeles because this isn't overseas. And I'm not, you know, this, it may be the other coast, but this is not what I signed up to do." And they basically said, "Well, we haven't got another role, and we'll just put you on some standard business." A week later, the gentleman who was running the agency in Asia knocked on my door. He had heard about me. I'd heard about him half a year prior. And he said, "Could he come in and have a chat?" And he walked out 2 hours later, and I had a job to go to Hong Kong.
And how long ago was that? What year was that?
27 years ago now.
27 years. And so Hong Kong, you were there for how many years before you moved on?
I was there for 4 years. So this year I've lived across the mark where I've lived more of my life now in Asia than the United States. So I took the job sight unseen because I'd spent time in Europe and was sort of hoping for a posting in Germany or Italy. But I figured I could survive anywhere for a couple of years and make a go of it. And I remember getting on a plane at the end of a relationship in New York and being sick the entire ride to Hong Kong, because I think just the stress of the change and all the rest. And was sick most old days in Northwest Orient before it became Northwest, before it got sold. And luckily in the last segment of the flight from Japan, Narita down to Hong Kong, the plane was empty, so it was economy and managed to lie down and have a sleep. And I woke up feeling kind of fresh. And I remember still stepping off the plane in the old Hong Kong airport, Kai Tak, where you do this incredible bank over the buildings and land. It was one of the few places in the world where pilots loved to fly in there because you literally could not fly autopilot. Literally could not. You had to land it manually. And, you know, plane comes bumping down and we got off and the doors opened, and it wasn't an air bridge. It was, you know, stepping off and going onto a bus. And I literally remember stepping out of the plane and took one look and was instantly in love. was in love with Asia, and the voice just kind of said, you're not going to go back.
And the voice was right. And this was back in a time when you really had no affinity, no training, no background, or it just Hong Kong was another destination on the map.
It was so utterly captivating as a place. And, you know, it just went from there, and the captivation just increased by the day, and frankly still is with me. I mean, I still wake up every day utterly thrilled to be in Asia. Literally, I know it sounds a bit silly, but every day I look out and go, I'm in Asia, and this is amazing. So it was the start of a journey that's, you know, never sort of waned in terms of its interest or intensity. And so I started out in Hong Kong, and it was an amazing place to start out, especially at that time, pre-turnover in Hong Kong. And again, you know, the lens...
That was 1997 when China took back from the British.
Well, yeah, 97 was the turnover, but I landed there at the end of 89.
Right.
And at the time, it's hard to fathom this looking back, but at that time, 97 still felt a long way away. And Chris Patton was the governor in Hong Kong. He was trying to really fight for the sort of future rights of Hong Kong, which seemed very odd because the Chinese were just going to wait them out. In Chinese terms, 7-8 years is a blip in history. It's irrelevant. So they just sort of let him rant and knew that time would take care of it. But it was a time of interest and anxiety in Hong Kong because the people sensed that 97 was coming, and there were a lot of the Hong Kong people that were getting citizenships, particularly in Canada and the UK. And, you know, it was kind of sad that America was very slow on the mark because they eventually offered a number of passports to Hong Kong people. But by then it was undersubscribed because most of the people that were going to seek a passport had already found one in Canada. That's why you had the boom in Vancouver, et cetera, or in the UK. But, you know, so some people were worried about it, but it still felt a long way away.
Yeah. I mean, those were, ironically, the big boom years. Economically, it was on fire. Property was going like gangbusters. The markets were opening across the border. The special economic zones in Shenzhen were just blisteringly, you know, opening up and creating new opportunities for people. Yet there was this panic and this concern about, you know, where are we headed and what's China going to do once it takes back Hong Kong.
Absolutely. It was exactly right. And, you know, what's interesting, again, with the lens of history now, which seems so obvious in retrospect, was, you know, it was China was just starting to open up. And I remember that winter going to Shanghai my first time and staying on the Bund, and Pudong didn't exist. I mean, it was just a bunch of fields and some billboards across the river, basically, from the Bund. But, you know, Hong Kong was very much the center of things, and it was the go-go time in Hong Kong. And, you know, it's amazing because I've been very fortunate not only to be in Asia, but to be in Asia during this period of time in history. Because I just don't think you're going to find another 25-plus year period where you're going to have quite the same degree of just dramatic change. I mean, China, every estimate shows, will continue to grow, but it's a bit like a teenager that's gotten a lot of its height. It's not going to suddenly double that height. And I think it's virtually impossible that China will do again in the next 25 years the scale in which the change has happened the last 25 years. And that's, you know, that's to a degree true in other places in Asia too. So it was, again, fool's luck that got me to Asia. It wasn't fool's luck that kept me in Asia. But during that time, I've been so fortunate to see just an incredible scale of change.
In terms of the advertising agencies, the advertising sector, it was in its infancy. I mean, to a large degree, a lot of organizations are trying to figure out how does advertising work in Asia. You didn't have the cable and satellite TV networks that are up and running. Mobility was coming in about the mid or early 1990s. And then you hopped onto it, this idea of digital and digital marketing. And at a time in Asia when people could, in fact, leapfrog some of the traditional advertising mechanisms and methods that have been used traditionally in the U.S., Europe, and elsewhere. And that's where, I mean, I'm holding here, for those of you who can't see, it's called Digimarketing, The Essential Guide to New Media and Digital Marketing. This was published in 2008 together with Ian Fenwick, and Kent and Ian came out with this book, and it is the Bible. And I said this to him, he's smiling right now, but he knows it's true. And I read this as a young guy who was trying to understand digital marketing, but it really did, in many ways, set the tone and the pace for what was going to happen in the ensuing years. But tell us a little bit about your experience in kind of launching that for Ogilvy and presenting digital to the markets.
Well, I guess the starting point is the view that information has become over the years more and more perfect, as they say. And even back then, a lot of what's happened now was pretty clearly forecasted. And it just seemed, having experienced by that point a number of years in Asia and just seeing the incredible weight of the tectonic shift of urbanization, middle class growth, the wealth effect in Asia, that I really realized fully, viscerally from my life and traveling in Asia, how much these big changes, how much these big trends really bring about dramatic change on a scale that's hard to imagine. And so we were looking at the data that was talking about the growth of mobile phones, which were already big back in 2008, obviously, but just where it was going to go with, eventually 3G technology, what was going to happen with digital proliferation, the impact of data on steroids, which is what you get with digital today. And it was an attempt to look ahead to say, the tectonic shift you see that's happened economically with Asia was going to also happen in advertising and social terms given technology. So it was our attempt at the time to kind of say marketing was going to be refashioned around digital. And, while a lot has changed in the landscape versus if you read the book now, some of it seems very passe. But the thing I'm most proud about is that the core premise we were saying of this is a shift, a permanent shift that you have to get on, that people will get on, was absolutely right. And, a lot of the premise of the book about some of the foundations of it, such as the incredible importance and use of data, is more true than ever. So, we were trying to encourage people, as we still are, to recognize these shifts. And, it's a one-way street in our view. It's not going to go backwards. And I think it's about understanding the weight of these truly big changes that happen with technology and lives and, as a result, marketing. Because marketing simply comes out of human life. I mean, it's some would argue in some cases maybe it seems the lead trend, but in a lot of cases, marketing is a reflection of what humans are wishing to do. That's what good marketing is, and sometimes it invents things that humans then wish to do. But in a lot of cases, it looks at what humans are doing and say, how do we take advantage of that? How do we ride upon that? And so I've always been amazed, even after publishing this, and I've spent a lot of the last 18 years, 20 years actually, talking with clients and others about the changes in marketing and particularly the digital implication, is it's shooting fish in a barrel. I mean, it's obvious where the world is going with technology to some degree, and it's certainly obvious that it's going to become more important, not less. And I'm always amazed by the number of people that are still not as knowledgeable as they could be. There's nothing rare about a lot of this. A lot of these things, if there's a term you don't know, if you don't understand what's happening with data, if you don't really understand what's happening with new forms of modern marketing, you can read about it online. It's not like it's a closed society that you have to have some rare knowledge. But I'm amazed by the number of people, professionals in the business, who still don't spend enough time becoming literate in what is happening with ad exchanges, what's happening in new techniques in terms of performance marketing or automated marketing, which is another new edge of where marketing is going. The book at the time was an attempt to say to people, this is where the world's going. Invest your time and energy in where it's going. Now, not everything is perfect in terms of guessing it exactly right, but in the general sense of the drift of it, it's a bit like the big trends of Asia. You can, urbanization, other things I talked about, you can kind of extrapolate and go, okay, these will impact the future.
This is Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. Our topic today is the shape and the impact of the digital revolution in Asia. My guest is Kent Wertheim, co-CEO for Ogilvy & Mather Asia Pacific. After the break, we'll be discussing Asia as a forerunner in mobility and mobile applications. Let's get back to my conversation with Kent Wertheim. In the segment you're about to hear, we're talking about how 10 to 15 years ago, there were many in Asia who didn't even have the fixed line phone networks that we take for granted in the West. That meant Asia went straight to mobile. Some say that it had not been for Asia, Nokia would never have made the leap from a forestry company to a mobile phone manufacturer. Its first generation phone buyers were found in Asia. Adoption rates of mobile devices and data services soared in Asia. Texting first took hold in this part of the world, as have so many early stage mobile innovations. I asked Kent how this disrupted our idea of the West being the home of innovation in the digital age.
We recently published a study about the future of growth. And I'm mentioning it here because one of the points we make is that I really think it's time to retire the term emerging market. So, you know, emerging market was a term that was used, is used today still commonly, but I don't think should be, to express a view about these markets that are quote-unquote developing markets. And it's often used in financial circles to talk about, you know, potential investment markets. But the truth is, a lot of the markets that are even termed emerging market, I mean, China, how can you call that an emerging market in a multipolar world? Or in India, or even in Indonesia, that's a trillion-dollar economy. So the reason I raise this is that I think one of the problems with that term, even besides the fact that it's just inaccurate today, is that somehow there is a kind of gradualist or almost colonialist view of these markets as emerging, as somehow inferior or catching up or slightly backwards or behind. And to the point you're just making, in a lot of areas, in fact, the numbers show it, the adoption rates are higher in Asia for technology than other parts of the world. I know America likes to think of itself as the great leader because of great companies like Apple, Microsoft, and others. But the reality is, a lot of what's shaping the future of e-commerce are the Alibabas of the world, the major tech players like Huawei. There have obviously been Japanese and Korean tech players for quite some time. But just the daily usage of social media, of not just, you know, the Western platforms, but LINE and other Asian platforms, the way Asians are using it, you know, you can't have this emerging market kind of mentality, because you're assuming that somehow they're catching up when in fact they're leading. And I think one of the hard things, and I've been very blessed in my time in Asia to see, is that there are more and more areas of the world where Asia really is leading. And, you know, politics aside, I think America has to wake up to the fact that there are a lot of very competitive, smart places that you need to look at and understand to know where the world is going. And certainly America has a leading role in the world, but it does not have a monopoly on leadership in so many areas today. It's a multipolar world.
Yeah, I mean, an area of robotics, for instance, Japanese are forerunners in the space of robotics. We're looking at, you know, China has been the manufacturing base for the last 15 years for the rest of the world, and now they're displacing some of their inexpensive labor with robots, right? We're looking on automating. We talked earlier about artificial intelligence and some of the threats and risks associated. So it's not all, you know, wonderful, hopeful, optimistic stuff. There's a bit of a darkness and an underbelly to the progression of technology in Asia and elsewhere. You want to comment on some of that?
I think you've seen in the last couple of years just a growing anxiety. I mean, there have been for many decades. Obviously, you look back in popular culture, how from many years ago, a fear of the role of technology in people's lives. And some people have, you know, poo-pooed that, but you can also look at, you know, I guess it was last year or the year before that The Economist was talking about the number of white-collar jobs that will be displaced by technology. So I think there's, you know, very valid reasons around the world. And, you know, I know obviously with the recent elections in the States, the discussion about, you know, the view that people are losing out and losing out to other parts of the world. But people have to realize there's a general global anxiety about human beings losing out to technology, you know, in a slightly more benign, but not that benign of a sense of people losing livelihoods to automation. But in a much more dramatic sense, the worry about, you know, what will singularity mean for the human race? So, you know, even though that kind of lower issue is still a significant issue, if you think I'm going to lose my job to a computer or to an algorithm in the future. And again, that's not science fiction. You got a lot of people in business saying that is the next wave of business. So, you know, there's always this hope that economics means that there'll be other value creation that soaks up the human capital, but there's a lot of anxiety that it doesn't get soaked up, it just gets left behind.
Yeah, it's almost like the party is starting to end a little bit, and we're waking up to the fact that technology brings with it some dilatory effects and some negative implications. And, you know, whether it's artificial intelligence and whether it's displacement by computers, or whether or not it's social media and fake news and some of the things that are now driving and shaping the world we live in, as a guy who's been tracking, watching, monitoring, promoting technology for 30 years, what are your thoughts about some of the cautionary notes you might cast on how we should apply these methods of digital marketing and media?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I remember Alvin Toffler's Future Shock, which was now a very, very old book, was so prescient. And I remember reading it years ago when he talked about the shattering stress of communication on human societies in the future. And we're there now for a lot of people that are just feel overwhelmed in their daily lives by just the amount of email and social media and other things that they don't welcome. You know, one could argue younger generations don't feel stress at all. That's just their natural habitat. But I think there's definitely, amongst at least certain generations or certain people, a sense of stress around technology. I think that stress is increasing. You know, it goes back to just the nature of the technology and the economics of it. Because as a marketer, you know, I grew up in the days when, the old days of advertising and direct marketing. You know, in the old world of direct marketing, which was at the time, you know, something you sent through the mail, you had to get the economics of it were simple. If you sent somebody an envelope and just the cost to put a stamp on it and get an envelope, stick something in it, even not something good, but just stick anything in it, cost you a certain amount of money. You'd have to get sort of a 2% response rate just to kind of break even generally. With digital technology, the cost to serve, to send another incremental junk mail is so small that your response rate can be dramatically smaller and you're still in the money. So the fact is, just the economics of it means there's a lot more stuff that can be pumped out at a lot lower cost with a lot less receptivity, and I still make more money than I did in the old days if I do that well. And that's part of why you see this incredible proliferation on a commercial sense. And then add to it, of course, every person who wants to now pump out their personal story, the food they ate last night, what they're thinking at that particular moment, what, you know, how silly their dog looks in the snow, whatever it might be. And, you know, you have just this incredible, overwhelming proliferation of content that we all live with today. And some of us like, and some of us like portions of it, and some people hate all of it. It's, you know, it's a range of people. But from a commercial sense, you know, we have to accept that the economics drives a lot. And the ability to create and disseminate information now, the economics have changed so dramatically. Just even shooting a piece of content. I mean, you know, you grew up in the old days of advertising. There was a basic cost of doing a TV commercial, and it was not a cheap, generally. You could shoot some cheaper advertising, but generally to produce some good-looking content costs you a certain amount of money up. Today, you know, with technology, there's a lot of very high-quality, very cost-effective, efficient production. And the cost of dissemination's very little. Now, you may want to promote it. That costs money. But again, the economics of the creation of content, the dissemination of content, just at its rawest point, it's a new physics.
And this, the overwhelming supply is now, you know, shaping people's behavior. So now we start to self-select and say, I only have X amount of capacity. I'm going to start to kind of decide on what I will and won't receive. And of course, with that, there comes a narrowing, a funneling. And with that, we have concerns about, are people really getting the full picture? Like opening a magazine or opening a newspaper and letting your eye drift to one headline to the next, you're actually sometimes pleasantly surprised, opening your mind to the possibilities. In the world of digital, you choose what you receive when you receive it. How is this impacting Asians? Is it the same way and the same effect that we're having elsewhere? Are people, you know, are you seeing the same kind of divisions among people that you're seeing in the U.S. or elsewhere as a result of this type of feeding and receiving of data and information?
Well, I mean, the truth is agencies are paid to sell clients' products. So you know, we obviously have an obligation, a legal obligation, not to do anything incorrect. We have a moral obligation not to do anything that is that generally causes harm. And our, you know, our obligation is to our client, and those clients as companies that have to be good corporate citizens generally try to follow some guidelines. The reality, though, is we don't wake up every day worrying about social good in general. We wake up worrying about, can we help our clients promote their products? So when you do something for client, they're looking at the ability to promote and sell their particular product. They're not saying, I'm not going to sell my product today because I worry about, but there's too much information today, so therefore I'm not going to send anything out today. So, I mean, that's an honest and correct lens of the reality of things. You know, the challenge is that there's a lot of material out there, and, you know, people are increasingly living in a self-selected world where they want to opt out as a result, and they're going, give me only this. I don't want news. I want fun, or I don't want this picture. I want that picture. I'm only interested in cats. I don't care about dogs or whatever level of weeding. But people have to realize that this is where marketers and just others who aren't involved in marketing need to understand the new physics of all this. This is a different world with targeting, retargeting, with what you do with technology today. You may make a choice in saying, I want this in my feed. But by virtue of what you do, you're also making a choice, because what you're retargeted to do, if you look for, you're going to go to Turkey on a vacation, chances are you're going to be served material. You'll find, as most of us experience, you're going to see a lot of ads for flights and, you know, tours in Turkey popping up again and again. It's not magic. It's a retargeting. It's cookies that are indicating that you've expressed a preference through your behavior. So even when you don't self-select a narrowing, I'm not going to serve you an ad to go to Australia necessarily. If you've already been searching for Turkey, I'm going to serve you another ad to go to Turkey, because I'm assuming you're in the business of wanting to go to Turkey. So now you're a ripe consumer. So just by action, you create a narrowing. And this is, and that's not self-selection. That's the technology working.
Right.
And that's the part that becomes very interesting to look at in terms of the implications of that.
That was Kent Wertheim, co-CEO of Ogilvy & Mather Asia Pacific and author of Digimarketing, The Essential Guide to New Marketing and Digital Media. Thanks for listening. And yes, it's time for our traditional wrap-up, referred to here at Inside Asia as bungkus. If you're new to the show, here in Bali, a bungkus is a traditional on-the-go rice meal. It's our segue into a final few thoughts. I left my conversation with Kent thinking about what he referred to as the stress of communication. It's a phrase reminiscent of the futurist and author Alvin Toffler, who during the late 1960s suggested that accelerated change threatened our psychological well-being, triggering a condition he called future shock. It became the title of his landmark book. I'm actually staring at the weathered copy of my own paperback version as I record this. I can't help but wonder what Toffler would say if he were here today. Have we slipped into a shell-shocked world of hyperactivity induced by too much information and too narrow a bandwidth? Have we actually gone mad, as Toffler predicted, or have we adjusted our definition of insanity to accommodate the change? Perhaps we've simply emerged after 50 years of high-speed evolution, reformatted to function at a higher, faster level. Toffler envisioned the stress of communication as a real thing, a real threat. Now we are one with it. We live in a world where tens of thousands of mental actions and reactions occupy our every minute. We intertwine and sometimes convolute our professional, personal, emotional, and if time allows, spiritual impressions of the world by the millisecond and spit them out through a wild array of digital mediums. And to what end? Are we trying to be heard? Or are we trying to hear? This is the reality of our situation, Kent tells us, when it comes to our digital selves. Our minds are made up for us, and our biases are confirmed invisibly, even inevitably. Know thyself, said the man once upon a time, an injunction that might be modified or expanded to include our technology. Know your machines. Know your algorithms. The system dreams in total darkness whether you ask it to or not. Is that a bad thing? If Alvin Toffler were here, I wonder what he'd say. Until next time, I'm Steve Stein, inviting you to come in from the outside on Inside Asia.